We're here with Agnieszka Holland, who is most recently the director of In Darkness. Agnieszka, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
I am fascinated by cinematic environments, and in this, you have a rather intricate sewer system. And I'm curious how you go about deciding this. My understanding was that you shot much of these sewers in different cities. I mean, when you're dealing especially also with a Holocaust movie, I mean, what do you use as the source to recreate the sewers on film? I mean, do you go back to photos? Do you see what's available? I mean, how much of the 21st century offers exemplars that will be good for a film like this?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to make this film, it was that most of the action happened in the sewers, in the underground. And I found it, like, fascinating, very challenging for the filmmaker and for the entire crew. And also the metaphor of the time and situation. It means psychological and physiological metaphor and historical metaphor. So it was, you know, it was... the sewers didn't change. It means in most of the cities you don't see the big changes from 50, 20, 100 years ago. Mostly it didn't change from the time when it was constructed, and most of the sewers have been constructed at the beginning of 20th century or sometimes even in the 19th century.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from this point of view, it wasn't so difficult to find the locations. We knew that the big part of the sewers we have to recreate on the stage, because it will be terribly difficult to shoot entire story in the real sewers, and it will cost us a lot of money and efforts.
To say nothing of the smell, perhaps.
Well, yeah. We didn't shoot it, and then we did some kind of the extended research in the cities we knew that we can shoot in. First we went to Lvov, to the real city, which is Ukraine today, which was Poland before the Second World War, and visited the real sewers when our characters have been spending this over a year. And those was the wars. It means they've been really very, you know, tight, low, sticky, smelling, very claustrophobic, and the ventilation was terrible. So after 1 hour, everybody, you know, escaped this place, and I cannot imagine till now how they've been able to live there.
Sure.
Then we visited the sewers probably in 10, 15 cities.
Yeah.
And we picked as a main sewers Łódź in Poland, and they are really good because, you know, it's also you have in some scenes even like 60, 70 people. Even more, the extras and actors, 100, and you have entire crew, and you have to put the camera someplace. So you have to find the places where it's possible, technically possible to shoot.
It may be a good location, but you may not be able to fit a camera in there, basically.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And lights, and you know, and hide the lights, and all this stuff. So, which was fantastic, and they've been also the city was very welcoming and very, you know, helping us a lot, and the sewer workers have been great. And in Leipzig we shot, and in Berlin. In Berlin we shot one scene only, but in real shit sewers.
Yeah.
Because we have two kinds of sewers. We have like rain sewers, you know, the water sewers.
Yes.
Canalization kind of, you know, from the draw of the water, rainwater, but also when the people take bath or, you know, shower or something, the water is going to those sewers. And after you have the sewers when your shit is going. And they are joining in some sections, in some kind of, you know, of the places where two sewers are coming together.
Yeah.
But of course, we tried mostly to shoot in the water sewers, but still, it wasn't easy.
At the risk of continuing this conversation and steering it into the shitter, I actually have to ask, did you have a fixed idea in mind about what the sewer must look like on film? Did your peregrinations into these 15 cities change your mind? At all, and did you have to sort of improvise around your original idea of what the visual...
I became quite knowledgeable about it, and actually, it's more spectacular than I thought, you know? It's the guy, it's the, you know, website, and the one guy who is the obsessed with the sewers, and he's photographing, filming...
Oh, a sewer expert, you found.
All the sewers over the world. And some are incredibly spectacular. For example, in Montreal, it looked like in the, you know, in the fantasy movie. It's full of the stalactites and bizarre, like, forms and so.
Yeah.
But anyway, I watched another movies which played in the sewers. It wasn't so many, but it was several of the scenes in the sewers. It was one movie by my mentor and friend Andrzej Wajda, Polish filmmaker, called Canal.
Yeah.
He shot in 50s, which entire action happens in the sewers of Warsaw. So that was very good example what kind of the challenges you have. And after Third Man, but you know, with Orson Welles. But what I wanted absolutely avoid, it was this beauty of the sewers. Because, you know, if the cinematographer puts the big lamps in the bottom of the tunnels, suddenly you have this counter lights and it looks like Gothic Cathedral or something.
Yes.
It looks quite spectacular. I didn't want it. I wanted this darkness and, you know, and dullness of the reality they've been living in. So,
but some might also argue that darkness is in some sense beautiful, and often when we only see a little bit of the sewer and our minds are able to imagine what's remaining in there, it almost becomes a sort of seductive beauty, almost a false beauty. I'm wondering how you work this out with your cinematographer.
Well, we tried not to romanticize this, you know, and we've been avoiding, for example, candles, you know, the light, this warm light, which makes everything in some way, you know, beautiful, except of two or three situations where it was, you know, like in purpose used. We wanted to, it was the most challenging, it was to balance the real darkness, and I really wanted the actors to be in the dark, not to pretend that they are in the dark.
Yeah.
And because you can lit it a lot, and after in the post-production just, you know, put it down, and if the sources are stronger, it will play. But I wanted actors to be in the real darkness.
Yeah.
But in the same time, you need to see the things which are important to see.
Yeah.
For the action, for the information, for the feelings of the people, for the psychology of the characters, emotions and so. So it was a big craft, and I think the woman who was my cinematographer, she's extremely talented and thoughtful. So she did it. We achieved it. And sometimes it was the actors lighting themselves or other partners, you know. Very often it was just a flashlight which lit, you know, the but it pushes, it is maybe tiring to some extent, but in the same time, it pushes the audience to the extreme focus, you know. The people have to be like very concentrated on watching, you know, what is on the screen. And I think it's what's exactly what we wanted. And it plays well.
Yeah.
The movie, the first country where the movie opened widely is Poland, like 10 days ago. And it's very successful, and the reaction of the people during the screenings and after are very similar in all cities, and they don't move during the, you know, during the screening. That, for example, they are buying the popcorns before going to the theater, and they come out from the theater after 2 hours 20 with the cups full of popcorn. They didn't even touch the popcorn. So, you know, it is what we wanted.
Sure. Well, going back to this idea of actors being in darkness, which is very interesting, because I know that this is obviously a movie that has multiple languages. You have one character who insists that you must speak German to be a cultured man and all that.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about this, because I know that you spent many months getting the actors to speak in these languages. And I'm wondering, how much does an actor really need to be steeped in advance of the role to get this kind of realism? I mean, is there a sort of maximum threshold where, well, hey, you're kind of researching too much, or is your attitude, well, hey, no preparation's enough?
Well, I think that they had enough of time to prepare well, and they are speaking really well, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yiddish and German, and then German actors learn Polish, and some Polish actors like Socha, the main character, and two others learn the special kind of the slang, balwak it's called, which contemporary Poles don't understand, but the, you know, the lower class people in Poles in Lwów before the war was speaking this kind of the language. So I think it helped them to go, this process of the, you know, linguistic school we had for like 2 months or so, it helped them to go deeper into the character. It's like kind of the method, you know.
Yeah.
I was working several times with Ed Harris, who is a friend and also method actor. And for example, when he played Beethoven, he really learned the conducting, and he was able to conduct, you know, the Ninth Symphony with the big orchestra, and it helped him to be the character. Jennifer Jason Leigh was like that. A lot of American actors are like that. Polish actors wasn't used to that before, not all of them, but some of them have the same need and same tendencies. So it was, I think it was instructive for everybody.
So working with the likes of Ed Harris and Jennifer Jason Leigh has allowed you to get some of these method acting techniques in place among the Polish actors and the like.
In some way, yes. Yeah. It means... Some actors have the natural instinct, you know, to make this research. They need it for their process. Some actors don't need it for their process, you know. Some actors are very, they even dislike it in some way. They want to be more spontaneous, I don't know what. But in general, I think that this kind of the preparation cannot hurt, that it's mostly very helpful.
Does this level of very hardcore preparation affect the casting sessions? I mean, do you perhaps see some actor, wow, that person has it, but maybe they're not so good when throwing themselves into linguistic school or throwing themselves into darkness? I mean, has this ever been, was this an issue either on this film or other films as you've moved more towards this realism? Or?
No, I knew that all the actors I'm considering, they have those kind of the potential. It means I was looking more on their physical aspect. For example, they will be not too fat for the, you know, for the Jews who are already 2 years in the ghetto. And the actors who are generous, who wants to open up to the different reality. But most of Polish actors are theatrically trained. They are, you know, well-trained actors, so they have really, the craft is big enough to deal with this kind of the challenges.
I wanted to talk with you, because it actually came up in a conversation I had a few weeks ago with the Australian novelist Elliot Perlman. We were talking about the notion of Holocaust fatigue, and how some books or films that deal with the Holocaust have to now face this dilemma. I mean, I was looking at some of the reviews and some of the write-ups of this film, and I noticed, for example, that A.O. Scott suggested that the Holocaust movie has become a genre in its own right. And in Tablet, you have Daphne Merkin suggesting that the audience for Holocaust films is even smaller than the audience for Ukrainian imports. But on the other hand, I think one of the things I appreciate about this film and also Europa Europa is that you have characters who are, you know, committing adultery, who are shooting up, who are masturbating, and as a result, you have behavioral quirks that almost defy these labels. So, you know, what do you do when you're making a Holocaust narrative of any kind to get away from these tropes? Does it really come down to these behavioral quirks, or what?
Well, you know, I think that the Holocaust was such an important event in the human history and the border point of the humanity. I don't think it will disappear as a subject, even for the next generation. I think what happened really, it was too many of pretty superficial and not very good treatments of this period and of this subject, which changed it to some kind of the moralistic, sentimental kitsch. And I think really, this kind of the things, treatment, the people have enough.
Yeah.
It means in the first it was like educationally important and woke up some kind of the, you know, knowledge and curiosity, but after it became some kind of a cliché. For me, it's important that it's not like that you cannot label it as a Holocaust. It's, you know, it is not really a Holocaust film, or it's not the film about Polish-Jewish relationship. It's the film about the human condition in particular circumstances and what, you know, the human nature is able to do, to give, to deliver the best and the worst.
Yeah.
And that is a universal question which you can also translate to the another, you know, sensitivity and another times. I think personally that, you know, the only thing which is important if it's artistically successful and if it's honest, humanly speaking and psychologically speaking and historically speaking, if it's dishonest or bad, it's bad. If it's really powerful and goes straight to the heart of the people, you know, I think that. We of course had the ambition to shot into the heart of the people, and the brain comes later, you know.
Yeah.
And if after it wakes up the reflection, what it was, how it was possible, when was my nation in that, how I will act in those circumstances, that is a bonus.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. But on the other hand, you as a filmmaker are competing with, for example, the downfall meme on the internet, where they take that scene and put different subtitles with Hitler. You know, Hitler has learned this. And I mean, you know, as a result, any serious consideration of the Holocaust now has to compete with these caricatures. Although, oddly enough, there is, I guess you were sort of ahead of the trend with the Hitler who's in Europa.
Right.
But how do you deal with this? Does it really come down to creating subcultures, behavioral quirks along these lines that defy all tropes?
Well, you know, it's where we are today. And anyway, you know, the internet and the using of the artifacts and the pieces of art on the internet and the glue, cut and glue, you know, kind of it exists. You cannot do anything about it.
Yeah.
And of course, you can ask the question: how long the regular dramatic narrative will survive, and if it will change to something different, to some kind of, you know, interactive games or something like that. I don't know, but by now it still exists, and you still can touch pretty amazing amount of people with that. So
yeah, I was always curious, I've been wanting to ask you this: why are you so interested in frauds and swindlers and those who have secret identities or who are pretending to be somebody else? I mean, even in this film, you've got con men who, you know, there was the pretense with the cash, you know, Olivier, is the boy real or not, things like that. Is this, I suppose, the result of growing up in pre-Solidarity Poland? Just this natural curiosity?
Probably.
Or is it just good for narrative?
Probably in Polish-Jewish family also, where, you know, I had to, like, change those hats depending who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
So it's, in some way, the party is my own experience. And being woman in the men's world also, you know. And in general, I think that the people are, you know, wearing the masks all the time. So that is, like, the, you know, the basic human problem, who we are really in the depth of our, you know, of our identity and what we pretend, and if the real identity really exists. Mm-hmm. Or it's just, you know, the function of the circumstances. If it's something like the true myself someplace, and the rest is just some kind of the appearances, or the true myself doesn't exist. Everything is the appearances. It was the question which Europa asked in very, you know, vivid way. Because the guy had been like, you know, like the Zelig changing the identities depending on
And very fluke based as well.
Right. And you know, in Europa, what was paradoxical, it was that his identity was his circumcised penis. If he wasn't circumcised, probably he will become somebody else totally. And like that, he had to remember, you know.
No greater physicality than that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was also curious about this period during the 90s when you were directing movies based off of Henry James, you had The Secret Garden. You were sort of the literary culture go-to person for a while. And I'm wondering if that was simply because those were the offers you received, or whether you consciously went towards that direction. I mean, it's very interesting that after Europa, and Olivier, that's just what came about, like Total Eclipse and all that stuff. So I'm wondering how that happened.
Mm-hmm. It was partly the offers I received, but it was the offers I picked, you know, because in this time I had pretty big amount of offers.
Sure.
It's, you know, Secret Garden, it was, on one hand, it was a kind of a therapy to myself after doing three movies in a row, which dealt with very tragic events. It was very dark, so I had to go to very dark places, and I felt kind of the fatigue and depression, and I wanted really to make something lighter. And in the same time, it was my favorite book when I was a kid, and I thought that doing first American movie with the book, which was my favorite children book, and with the European subject and European, you know, reality, literary and historically speaking, it gives me some kind of the advantage, you know. And I was right. It means it was the movie which really people like and children liked, and, you know, international and so.
Yeah.
And I was pretty proud of doing it. It was some kind of a challenge. Washington Square is different. Washington Square, I really wanted to make Henry James more faithful to Henry James.
Yeah.
And mostly Henry James in this country was mostly made like the Jane Austen.
Yeah.
It means that it made some kind of the revenge story, romantic comedy out of that. And I thought that it's very, you know, also very dark and very honest portrait of the ordinary woman, you know.
Yeah. But it also takes a lot of guts to stand up against the heiress, which is right. very fixed in audiences' minds, at least
right.
certainly mine.
I had some courageous choices like that,
yeah.
which was partly unconscious. It means I didn't realize how deeply it's rooted in the people's you know, conscience. This I did the same thing with my daughter. We directed the historical story, which is the legend in Poland and Slovakia about the bandit from 18th century. And to everything which was before, it was very kitschy, and we thought we'll do something, you know, real. And the people, the audience showed that they prefer a kitschy version, you know. So,
yeah.
So sometimes you cannot succeed with the something which is so strong. Of course, Harris was a wonderful movie, but it was very much revenge story. It was very American in the modern way, and it wasn't like so universal to me as the book was.
One very quick last question I have to ask. David Simon assigned you Richard Price's scripts on The Wire. I'm wondering if he ever offered you any specific reason why Richard Price and you were just the match made in heaven.
I don't know. I think it was just by chance that it was the episode. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
They offered me to do The Wire. I watched The Wire, and I loved it. I think it's really like the great American novel, and it was for me the real journey, you know.
So Simon Cody just kept that up his sleeve.
Right.
Oh.
And they offered me because one of the producers, the woman, Nina Noble, she's been my line producer on the movie Shot in the Heart.
Yes.
I did for HBO, and she really liked me a lot, and she thought that I would be the right person. And they apparently liked me because after I did the pilot for Tremere. So suddenly I ended by doing the most American, you know, stories you can imagine,
yes.
right? So there's paradox.
Well, that's a wide swath of topics, and I know you have to go, but Agnieszka, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. That's where we all